Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. Come on home, baby. And now, your host, Gary Null. Oh, come on
home. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is going to be an empowering hour. You're going to learn about the dangers of excess estrogen in the aging male. New information that will really help save a lot of lives and also help a lot of men who look in the mirror one day and they start seeing the sagging skin and the wrinkles where they've been buffed and strong and tight skin. We're going to tell you about all that. New report from Bill Falloon. Then the powerful protective benefits of flower pollen. Dr. Heather Olive talks about the prostate health. We'll give you that. Also, we're going to talk about the carotenoids from green algae are fat burners. Plus, they're also great detoxifiers. Plus, they're also great chelators, getting heavy metals out. We'll talk about that. These will be more in-depth. My guest in the second part of our program from the United Kingdom is Dr. Nafees Ahmed. He is an investigative journalist, noted international security scholar, and he focuses upon the fundamental changes in the public interest. And we're going to talk about what is Google's relationship to the CIA, the U.S. Defense Department, and national security. It's not good. You should know about it. He is the scholar who's researched it. He'll share that with us. Also, the elephant in the room, the origin of modern terror and crumbling Western values, John Chuckman from Countercurrents. I believe that we have to have a whole new economic strategy, especially for people at all walks of life who are entering public service. So today, 10 policy proposals for building a new society. Yes, we can prosper without growth. I'm a person that does not believe in growth. I believe that we should do just the opposite. We should be shrinking certain parts of government, like the military-industrial complex, welfare for corporations, and the police state, and no subsidies for any corporations. But at the same time, we should, well, I'll tell you what we should be doing. New information from the changes, this changes everything, by Callis. And then, if time permits, we've all heard of the benefit of charter schools. In fact, I'm sure many of you have seen the movie that was such a blockbuster, Waiting for Superman. We critiqued that movie on this program and showed you the pros and cons of public schools versus charter schools and private schools. So today, Lori Levy of Alternet, facts about charter schools you won't hear from the National School Choice Week, which is going on now. And time permitting, a whistleblower from a major pharmaceutical company who worked there for 35 years, Dr. John Rengen Verapin. He was a former Eli Lilly company executive, and he decided to quit and speak out about Big Pharma's methods for profit and the benefit, symptomatic of that whole industry, and how that impacts negatively people's lives, even the duration of your life. So we'll discuss that. So we have an enormous amount of information to share. Let's begin. Yesterday I watched a video clip from Jesse Ventura. I was interested in light of the enormous popularity of American Sniper, which I critiqued on this program twice in a commentary, to be aware that he had sued the author of the book and the actual person who the movie was based on, this man named Kyle. And the Navy SEALs went against him. In effect, they threw him out. He is persona non grata. But he told his story about how he asked repeatedly, in person, face to face, just apologize. Show that that what you said happened in that bar didn't happen, and I'll let it go. And the man didn't. He had multiple choices to just say, "Oh, sorry, that was an error about Jesse Ventura being knocked out in a bar." Never happened. Anyhow, he took it to court, and in court, a jury found that Jesse Ventura was accurate and honest. He told the truth. And awarded him, having nothing to do with Jesse Ventura, over $1,800,000. And so that's the part that the media has failed to pay attention to. I guess people didn't realize that the person Ventura was suing was the same guy who was the model for and the true story of American Sniper. Anyhow, what I was watching was Ventura was wearing a tank top, and I'm looking at his arms and his neck, and I see this kind of sagging skin. And I'd never seen that before. He's been in the office many times in New York, and we talk, and he's always buffed. He's a big guy. He's 6'4", and I'm guessing he's around 250 pounds. And he was always very, very, very concerned about his physical being. And I'm looking at that saying, wow, there's the impact of not having the right supplements, not having the right diet, and having an imbalance in estrogen. And I think that's so important because if you want to have an anti-aging program, you have to be aware of the risks of having too much estrogen or too little estrogen because it definitely affects men. Now, here's what we should know. Stroke is the third leading cause of death and the leading cause of age-related disability. Abnormal blood clotting is in the cerebral blood vessels is the most common cause of stroke. Excess estrogen promotes abnormal blood clots. That's why guys who are on high-protein diets, they really pump estrogen, and they also are important in as far as testosterone. So you don't want either of those. You don't want high estrogen or high testosterone. You're more likely to have a blood clot. In fact, in a study published just last year, blood levels of estradiol, that's a potent estrogen, were measured in a group of 2,100 men and adjusted for age, hypertension, and diabetes, and cholesterol, and atrial fibrillation, and other characteristics. During the course, the men with the highest level of estradiol had a 220% greater risk of stroke compared to those with a lower level. So it's important. You have to know how you have the right amount of estrogen and too little estrogen and the right amount of testosterone and too much or too little. And excess estrogen mainly comes from eating animal proteins, dairy and meat. And we're a big meat-eating country. Now, when I was growing up, people didn't eat a lot of meat. They ate it frequently. You were told, and everyone believed, that we had to have meat 3 times a day. So there would be eggs and bacon or eggs and sausage with toast for the average person. I preferred oatmeal, like a porridge, with some cinnamon and honey in it with cream. And we got non-homogenized milk. It'd be delivered by a milkman, and then in the country, we'd go to the farm, and I would milk the cows, and we'd have it really fresh. And don't get any fresher than that. And all the cats would line up, and the dogs would line up, and they'd just be sitting there patiently. So when you're milking some in the bucket, you just squirt them over in them, and they just love that. And in any case, then for lunch, you'd have a bologna sandwich, believe it or not. Everyone where I grew up ate bologna. They loved it. Or Spam. They loved that as well. And then in the evening, that's when you had your big portion, which was either roast beef or chicken or sometimes a steak. In any case, everyone thought they were doing the right thing. And especially when you come from a working class background that I did, you were thought to be responsible as a mother when you could say that my family's eating the basic fours every day. That was one of the ways that, you know, you were considered responsible. Little did we know what it was doing. Now today, take away all of the guidelines of eating appropriate amounts and serving sizes. We just slop the food on the plate as much as possible. We have supersized meals, huge amounts of food. In fact, today, some people eat enough in one single item at one meal for an entire week in protein. Huge amounts of protein. And then fat. Well, there goes your estrogen. In a study 2 years ago, blood levels of estradiol were measured in hundreds of men. Their average age was 58, and carotid artery media thickness was measured at baseline and then 3 years later. After adjusting for all other risks, men with higher levels of estradiol suffered a worsening thickening of the carotid artery wall. This led researchers to conclude that circulating estradiol is a predictor of progression of carotid artery media thickness in middle-aged men. Now, I remember when a man came to me in 1993 at the Tri-State Healing Center down on 72nd and Broadway. He couldn't even walk up one short flight of stairs to get to the office. So I went down and we sat on the stoop outside for 2 hours. His wife, a nurse teacher, and his daughter, an Orthodox physician, were sitting in the car. They were not happy about this. He was an engineer, and his name was Ed Finkelstein, and his wife, a wonderful person, and they both became world-class athletes. In fact, they won together. Outstanding senior track and field athlete of the year at the USA Track and Field, the Metropolitan Athletic Congress, the best athletes in the tri-state area, and the New York Roadrunners Club. Quite simply, there were no better athletes in America for about, I'm going to guess, around 7 years. Anyhow, he was in his 70s when he came to see me, and he had a 96% blockage of his carotid artery. And he looked at the statistics and found that he had between a 15 to 20% chance of dying on the operating table for the operation they wanted to do, and a 35% additional chance of dying within 3 months a post-operation. And he said, those odds are just not worth it. I heard that you might be able to help me through lifestyle diet modification, but please understand, no one around me believes any of this, and my doctor thinks it's all quackery. But it's my life. I'm an engineer. I'm looking just unemotionally at the facts. So let's give it a try. And after I went over his diet and his lifestyle, it was relatively easy to see that he had a high estrogen intake, which in turn leads to thickening of that carotid artery, which in turn leads to having damage to your epithelial tissue that lines all of your arteries and veins. And that in turn leads to blockages, clots, and heart disease. It's relatively simple. So then the process was, let's reverse it. Let's de-occlude the arteries. Let's repair the epithelial tissue. Let's thin the blood naturally to prevent those clots and strokes. So we began a vigorous exercise program and juicing, and his wife was on board, but it was only after she developed Bell's palsy, which is a terribly disfiguring facial paralysis due to a virus, and it can last years. And it pulls the whole face down on one side, gives it a very warped perception of the face. And when she came in one day, I said, you know, we can deal with that. And she said, there's no treatment for this. I said, yes, there is. You're just not aware of it. And I said, I'm going to put you on a very vigorous protocol. Within 2 weeks of coming in 6 days a week, getting very high doses of vitamin C and other therapies, she saw it changing. Within 2 months, it was gone. Well, that changed her perspective because she taught nursing. She knew all about disease and its outcome. So together, they really went on a healing journey. By the way, they were also just two of the nicest people you'd ever meet. And their daughter eventually came around also on this. Well, we de-occluded his arteries. We cleaned up the arteries. We broke down the plaque, got it out of the body, got rid of the heavy metals. In effect, his biochemistry got a whole lot younger. But it was on a low estrogen diet, not a high estrogen. No meats, had to go strictly vegan. And lots of living foods and lots of nutrients and juices. And he's just one example. You can see both Ed and Dolly in several of the documentaries I did at the time. Now we know that men who have higher levels of estradiol, estra, E-S-T-R-A, diol, D-I-O-L, are going to have more heart attacks. It's just that simple. A study published just last year compared blood levels of testosterone and estradiol in men suffering from acute myocardial infarction or heart attack with those who had previously suffered a heart attack. And sex hormones were measured in patients presenting with acute heart attack and patients with old heart attack and patients with normal coronary arteries. And the results showed significantly higher levels of estradiol in both groups of heart attack patients compared with those without any coronary disease, as would be expected from numerous prior really good quality studies. Heart attack victims also had decreased testosterone levels. Too low a testosterone makes you susceptible to heart attacks. Too high a testosterone makes you susceptible to heart attacks. So that's why you gotta balance out the natural estradiol and the natural testosterone, because it makes an enormous difference. Now, the reason many men suffer from excess estradiol and deficient testosterone is their aging bodies produce less testosterone while more of their beneficial testosterone is converted, what is called erythronized, into estradiol. And the pathological result is an altering of the ratio of testosterone to estrogen, creating estrogen dominance. Well, women who have estrogen dominance develop a higher level of breast cancer and uterine cancer and ovarian cancer. And men end up with a higher level of prostate cancer. So this imbalance of estrogen overload and testosterone insufficiency is often overlooked as a cause of heart disease. So this way you understand it. So just remember, you do not want elevated estrogen levels in men or women, because you're going to end up with coronary problems, and that could kill you, and does. And so how do you get rid of this? Well, there's several things you can do. You want to protect your prostate, you got to get rid of that elevated estrogen level. And the breasts, you want to get rid of the same thing. And also you prematurely age. It ages your skin, hence the Jesse Ventura factor. In males, the main biologically active estrogen is called estradiol, and the primary source of estradiol in men is from the conversion of testosterone. So as men age, the production of androgens from the adrenal and gonads is decreased, and the testosterone to estradiol conversion is often maintained, but due to a variety of factors, more testosterone is converted in fatty tissue, causing a further imbalance of the ratio of testosterone to estrogen. So then you end up with all these aging factors. So how do you protect yourself? What is the takeaway message? It is not just excess estradiol that poses health risks. Specific estrogen metabolites may also initiate and promote hormone-related cancers. Daily consumption of your cruciferous vegetables. Good news. So please pay attention to this. Broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, mustard, Brussels sprouts, broccoli sprouts, kale. These are very important to have. Also, the organic isoflavon-rich soy foods, the organic non-GMO soy. And what this does is it converts these dangerous estrogen metabolites, such as 16-alpha-hydroxyone, to the good, safe, preventative disease, which are the 2-hydroxyestrione. That protects you from prostate cancer and breast cancer. So just remember, 16 alpha is bad, 2 hydroxy is good. 16 comes from your meat and alcohol. 2 comes from vegetables and fruits and soy. In fact, in the soy, in the cruciferous vegetables, you have a chemical. It's called indole, I-N-D-O-L-E, 3-carbinol, carb, C-A-R-B, inol, I-N-O-L, and sulfuraphane. And those protect you and protect you from the harmful chemicals. Also from soy, you get genistein and dadzine, both of which protect you. So you don't want real low estrogen. That's not good. But you want it in a safe range. In fact, I recommend an ideal range of estradiol for most aging men, meaning over the age of 40, between 20 and 30 pg/mL of blood. Below 18 increases osteoporosis risk, while greater than 30 increases heart attack and stroke. If you're eating a healthy diet, the ones I talk about every day on the program, you should be in that safe range. Now, that's a classroom on the air for health and nutrition. I will mention one other thing, and that is the carotenoids from green algae may inhibit the development of fat cells and the buildup of fat in fat tissue. And this is good research out of Japan, and it was published in the Journal of Nutrition. And these chemicals that they found in there, these what are called siphonaxanthin, significantly do great work when it comes to burning fat. This was done at Kyoto University. So eat your algaes, your green algaes like blue-green algae, chlorella, spirulina, to burn fat, help your body. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and nutrition, more of a classroom on the air to give you a greater in-depth. But hey, if it can save heart attacks and strokes and aging, then to me, it's worth spending the extra time on it to save a life. Now, I want to go to our environmental segment very quickly because there are several reports up today. The first is that I'm sure you've heard that President Obama proposes to open up our Atlantic waters to oil and gas drilling. And Sarah Lazar from Common Dreams says that's a horrible idea. Despite the objections of environmental groups and local residents, the Obama administration is moving forward with plans to open up large areas of federally owned waters off the Atlantic to oil and gas drilling. And the unfortunately, there has not been a push against it, and there should be. And because just remember, when you're in the Atlantic, you're deep. Just like at the Gulf of Mexico disaster, there's just going to be no way to fix that. And they're going to do it off Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina coasts. Not good. And so we should be protesting that. So protest opening up the Atlantic waters. And why are they doing this? They don't need to do this. Well, because this is a part of that idea of wherever you can get people to invest and there are fees to be made and income to go to the government, they do it. So you're not going to be able to avoid a catastrophic global problem if you end up with a major break in the floor of the Atlantic. It'd be a lot worse than the Gulf of Mexico. Also, we don't pay attention to it, but we should. You've heard me mention many times the pollinators. We have pollinators, moths, bats, bees, birds, but the bee is the most prolific and the best. According to the University of Vermont, a new study shows that more than half the people in some developing countries could become newly at risk for malnutrition if crop pollinating animals like bees continue to decline. Now, despite popular reports that pollinators are crucial for human nutritional health, no scientific studies have actually tested this claim until now. And the new research by scientists at the University of Vermont and Harvard University for the first time, connected what people actually eat in four developing countries to the pollination requirements of the crops that provide their food and nutrients. Quote, the take-home is, pollinator declines are really important to human health, with quite scary numbers for vitamin A deficiencies, for example, which can lead to blindness and increased death rates for some diseases, including malaria, end quote. So it's not just plummeting populations of bees. Scientists around the world have observed a worrisome decline of many pollinating species threatening the world's food supply. Just keep in mind, one-third of all the food we eat comes from pollination. So you start wiping out the bees because of the nicotinoid insecticides, the rich will always be able to buy what food is grown. But you're going to see millions upon hundreds of millions of people suffer from food scarcity, malnutrition, and early death. And finally, good news from Costa Rica. They ruled yesterday that GMO approval process is unconstitutional. So that's very important because it could then be used elsewhere. Costa Rica's Supreme Court has formally declared the nation's GMO approval process to be highly unconstitutional. And that amounts to the great news in the fight to regain the global food supply. The Constitutional Chamber of the Supreme Court of Costa Rica struck a blow against Monsanto and other major biotech firms in their recent ruling regarding the secrecy of the approval process itself. According to Chief Justice Gilbert Sancho, who actually authored the final verdict of the court, the nation's current approval process for planting of GMOs is veiled in, quote, secrecy, and directly goes against the constitutional right to freedom of information. This sounds a lot like a much less deceiving version of Monsanto's approval process here in the United States. Outside of virtually worthless safety testing funded by biotech itself, the USDA has even gone on public record in announcing they will, in fact, be rolling out a speedy approval process for the new lines of genetically modified seeds and creations. So could it be any more obvious that the USDA is in bed with Monsanto? So here's Costa Rica doing something that we have not been able to do in our own study country. Finally, according to David McCormick from Mail Online, a group of Harvard students were recently asked by their tutor to sit and do a 1964 Louisiana literacy test. That's a notorious document with confusing questions that was used to stop black citizens from voting in the 1960s and before. Just 50 years ago, states in the South asked voters who couldn't provide proof of a fifth-grade education to pass the test in order to be eligible to cast a ballot. The test was intended to disenfranchise African Americans, who in order to pass had to correctly answer all 30 questions in 10 minutes. Despite their Ivy League pedigree, none of the Harvard students managed to pass the test, and their reactions as they struggled to make sense of the obtuse questions was filmed. So, how fair was it back then that uneducated blacks were asked to take a test they could not pass, and given that test today by Harvard students, none of them, not one of them, could pass it? So much for fairness on any level. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
All things and what they used to be. wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury.
I'd like to welcome all of you. We'll be talking from the United Kingdom versus with Skype with Professor Nafees Ahmed on what is Google's relationship to the CIA, the U.S. Defense Department, and the national security agencies. It exists. We just have never been informed of it. Today, you'll find out the truth from this scholar. Right now, we're just taking a moment. Please pay attention. I'm going to offer you the greatest special in the history of this show. Here it is. You're going to get a case of red stuff and a case of green stuff. Now, normally, a case of red stuff capsules and a case of green stuff capsules would be a lot of money. Just the green stuff capsules is $600 a case. The red stuff capsules, $600 a case. Today, for the next 5 days, it's $195. $400 saving. This is one time only. Greatest special I've ever done. Now, why should you want the red stuff? Well, because we know how important fruits and vegetables are, but most people don't eat a lot of fruits, and the ones they eat every day. And they may not be eating the right ones. So we're going to help you with that. How about having cranberry, strawberry, apple, cherry, red raspberry, peach, pears, papaya, mango, watermelon, red currants, nectarines, pink grapefruits, blood oranges, pomegranates, pineapple, lemons, limes, tangerines, and apricots. That is what you're getting in each serving. 4,000 milligrams. All right? That's what you're getting. That's what's in there. So, that's one. So you're getting that in the red stuff. And red stuff is one of the most important single ingredients you can take every single day. These are the red stuff capsules, a whole case. And you're going to get a case of red stuff, case of green stuff. You're going to save $400 on the red stuff, $400 on the green stuff. That's $800 savings, $800. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. For those of you who use this on a regular basis, you will appreciate why this is so important. I just gave you the red stuff. Now, let's just say in a given day, you know how important your greens are. Are you taking in green camote, wheatgrass, barley, alfalfa, oak grass, broccoli, parsley, kale, pineapple, spirulina, yucca? I bet not. Now you will. You can take the green stuff and red stuff together. So that's it. You're getting the green stuff capsules, a case, the red stuff capsules, a case. Instead of paying $600 and $600, $1,200, you're only paying $195 for each case, saving $400 a case. The greatest special ever. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. This special will last 1 week only. So give a call. For those of you who care about issues, and I believe many of you do, I want to share with you ways that we can stimulate our economy in good ways, but not looking at growth of the gross domestic product and debt, but rather look at how we can downgrade, minimalize, be more efficient with what we have, and share more of the responsibilities and share more of what we have. I want to share something that from this Changing Everything, a gentleman named Callis. And by the way, there is a recent book. It's called Degrowth, a Vocabulary for the New Era. and that argues that the economic growth is not only becoming more and more difficult. Let's face it, we would need 2.5 planet Earths based upon how badly it is being exploited. China, India, Brazil, United States are at the top of that. In theory, growth is needed to pay off debts, create new jobs, or increase the incomes of the poor. In practice, we have had decades of growth, yet we are still indebted, with our youth unemployed and poverty as high as ever. We are indebted to grow, and now we are forced to grow to pay off debts. Of course, someone could forgive all those debts. That they could do, they won't. And yet when big industries and big banks had debts, trillions of dollars debt, we forgot it. We forgave it all. We wiped it clean. We took all their bad debts to the Federal Reserve, washed them through the system, gave them clean new money, and all those bad mortgages, all those bad investments, all gone. Trillions. Not a penny for the average person. So degrowth is a call to decolonize the social imaginary from the ideology of a one-way future consisting only of growth. Degrowth is not the same thing as recession. It is the hypothesis that we can achieve prosperity without economic growth. In other words, that we can have meaningful work without the need for everlasting growth, sustain a functional state without the economy getting bigger every single year, and increase equality and eliminate poverty without having to accumulate more and more money each year. So degrowth challenges not only the outcomes, but the very spirit of capitalism. And capitalism knows no limits. It only knows how to expand, creating while destroying. Capitalism cannot and does not know how to settle. Capitalism can sell everything, but it can't sell less. So a new paradigm is emerging. And in terms of the younger generation, it's happening in Europe, in Spain, Catalonia, in Greece, Slovenia, Croatia. So it's part of the green movement. It's a part of the alternative cooperative model for the economic inspired by the ideas of degrowth. So let me give you a few of these. First is citizen debt audit. What does citizen debt audit mean? It means an economy cannot be forced to grow to resolve accumulated debts that have contributed to fictitious growths in the past. It is essential not only to restructure, but also to eliminate part of the debt with a people's debt audit, part of a new, really democratic culture. And such elimination shouldn't be realized at the expense of savers and those with modest pensions, whether in Spain or elsewhere. The debt of those that have considerable income and assets should not be pardoned. Those who lent for speculation should take the losses. Once the debt is reduced, caps on carbon and resources will guarantee that this will not be used as an opportunity for more growth and consumption. Then work sharing. Americans just don't understand this, and we should, because they're doing it now around the world. And that is, you reduce the working week to at least 32 hours and develop programs that support firms and organizations that want to facilitate job sharing. And this should be orchestrated such that the loss of salary from working less only affects the 10% highest income bracket. And complemented by environmental limits and a tax reform that I suggest and have for a long time, one flat tax for all corporations, and you cannot get out of it. You'd eliminate the IRS. You'd eliminate people hiding behind a 70,000-page tax code and expensive lawyers, and they don't pay any taxes. Here's the irony. People say, oh, you know, the big corporations, the rich, you know, charge tax them more. What good would it do? As long as you have laws that they can avoid legally avoid paying taxes, they're not paying anything. So just have it so everybody has to pay who's earning an income from a business of any kind, and eliminate all personal income tax. Also, you have a basic and maximum income. So you establish what is a minimum between 400 and 600 euros per month paid without any requirement or stipulation. And a recent study suggested this is feasible for Spain without a major overhaul of the tax system. So at least you have that people cannot be exploiting the universe because they can create debt Remember, almost all the big deals of buying corporations and buying out whole areas is done with debt. So if they don't have liquid asset to buy it at a certain level, then they shouldn't be able to buy it. Because the 1%, the 100th of 1%, the 1,000th of 1% just keeps getting richer. And then let's have a green tax reform. Implement an accounting system to transform over time the tax system from one based upon principally on work to one based upon the use of energy and resources. So if what you're doing in your work, your corporation, is causing a whole lot of pollution, you should be taxed an absolute tax higher. And those who are creating very little pollution, a very small footprint in helping the environment, that would help them in subsidizing a smaller tax. And stop subsidizing and investing on activities that are highly polluting. Moving that liberated public funds towards clean production. Reduce to zero the public investment subsidy for private transport infrastructure and like airport expansion and new roads that they benefit from and military technology and fossil fuels and mining projects. Get rid of it. Use the funds saved to invest in the improvement of public roads and urban space, such as squares and traffic-free pedestrian streets, and subsidize public transport. And we need a national rail system, high-speed rail system, and then put that money also into alternative, non-polluting energies, wind, solar, geothermal. Support the alternative solidarity society. Support with tax exemptions and legislation, the cooperative movements. They're doing it in Spain, including alternative food networks, cooperatives and networks for basic health care, nonprofit hospitals and clinics, rehabilitation clinics in every neighborhood where you've got a problem, shared housing, artists teaching. Facilitate the decommercialization of spaces and activities, and also optimize use of buildings. We have over 10 million square feet not being used of state and community and federal housing in just New York City alone. We could rehabilitate that for much better usage for people and for projects. And also establish environmental limits. Do not allow people just to exploit the environment because they can afford to. And abolish the gross domestic product as an indicator of economic progress. It's a misleading indicator. We should stop using it and instead look for one based upon other factors like quality of life, longevity, the health of our environment, our water, our air, our soil, our children's health, life expectancy. That would make a difference. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to go to our guest, who is standing by now. We have a lot to share with him. Let's say hello now from the United Kingdom to Dr. Nafees Ahmed. I said earlier he is an investigative journalist, a filmmaker, best-selling author, and he's a noted international security scholar focusing upon fundamental changes in the public interest that will lead to holistic social transformation. He is a columnist for Vice's Motherboard and the Middle East Eye, as well as for the founding executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development, which is a transmedia think tank in the United Kingdom. And his most recent investigative project is Insurge Intelligence, which recently broke the story of the CIA's role in the creation of Google. And his articles and stories are published internationally, and he has received two project-centered awards, and he is co-producer and writer of the critically acclaimed documentary The Crisis of Civilization. He has also authored many investigative books, and his latest is Zero Point. It'll be released this year. His website, let me spell it for you, NafeezAhmed.com, and as well as patreo.com/Nafees. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me, Gary.
There's barely a person who works or relies upon the internet who is not in some way connected or uses Google. And the average person simply thinks the company is the product of two brilliant young entrepreneurs and visionary students from Stanford University, Bryn and Page, Larry Page. And that's fine. The same was said of Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and others who founded technologies that turned into extremely wealthy mega multinational corporations. However, looking back at Google, there is more than entrepreneurial inventiveness. As your recent investigative article presents, Google may not have been founded without Bryn's and Page's past network of consultation and mentorship and funding from government agencies, including the CIA and corporations and university departments directly connected with U.S. intelligence and defense agencies. But before we address Google specifically, would you first speak a little about the business and financial side of the CIA and the National Security Agency through their shadow corporations and investment firms and private sector think tanks and forums, because it is through these so-called private entities that the CIA and the U.S. intelligence is able to directly persuade and influence and infiltrate other private firms to do the government's bidding. So first speak a little about these shadow companies and the firms and how they operate and what has been their strategic agenda in monopolizing the Internet and for what ultimate purpose.
Sure. Well, I mean, over the last few years, I mean, obviously, especially in the wake of the Snowden revelations, we've become much more aware of the extent of the privatization of the intelligence services. And of course, you know, privatization is going on everywhere. But the extent to which, the national security apparatus has been outsourced to all manner of defense contractors for every conceivable kind of function of key elements of the military, especially information technology, is something which I guess many people are surprised when we find out the extent to which big companies like Booz Allen Hamilton, which was the employer of Edward Snowden. Other companies like, Science Applications International Corporation, which has now changed its name to Leidos. And, other names are very well known, Halliburton and Dick Cheney. But I think what's become clear is that there is a revolving door between many of these private sector outfits and, various intelligence agencies, government departments, advisory boards to the intelligence services and so on and so forth. We find that executives from these companies end up coming into government, and people in government end up going out once their term is over into these companies where they get very highly paid jobs. And that's why, I think the first time the extent of this was really exposed was actually, before Snowden, long before Snowden. But I think when it really came together was the investigative journalist by the name of Timothy Shorrock, who wrote his book, I think it was called Spies for Profit or something like that. And that was a fantastic book, and he really brought together the vast extent of what some have called, the shadow intelligence community, because of the extent to which they really actually have replaced many of the critical functions that we would have expected intelligence agencies to be doing themselves, is actually being done by these other companies, and they're getting contracts worth millions, if not billions, of dollars sometimes. So that's the kind of the background to my investigation and the kind of direction which I was looking. But what really kind of piqued my attention was this entity called the Highlands Forum, which I wrote about in my two-part story. And the Highlands Forum is a Pentagon kind of internal think tank, similar to another think tank which has received a small amount of media coverage, the Office of Net Assessment, often described as the Pentagon's internal kind of futures planning think tank. Well, this is a similar type of think tank, except it's received almost no media coverage, except a few bits, snippets here and there. And what I found was that the Highlands Forum, which is very difficult to get information about it, but I had to obviously go deep using Google search engine I found snippets about it in various books written by people who had participated in the forum. I ended up looking at some official records of the Pentagon, other kind of declassified documents, various bits and pieces of information, and eventually managed to build up a picture of this network. So this thing was set up in 1994, and basically what it does, it's been described as like the Pentagon's ideas lab, and it was set up in 1994, and according to Pentagon records, the whole point of the thing is to basically help the Pentagon formulate and coordinate strategies for information operations across all of its main agencies. So basically what Violence Forum does, it brings together a wide range of elites across American society, whether it's financiers, big investors, people from industry. You have about 25% of the people who attend the forum are people in government. That's senior people in the White House, senior DOD officials, and occasionally some officials from other departments as well. And they also bring together private defense contractors, people who work in the tech industry, people from Google, Facebook, various other promising tech startups, and so on and so forth. And even journalists, senior journalists and media professionals and executives in various American media companies. So these guys, they meet a couple of times every year. We don't really know very much about what goes on there. But what we do know is that companies like Booz Allen Hamilton and SAIC, or LIDOS, as it now calls itself, are two very prominent defense contractors heavily involved in contracting with the National Security Agency in particular and in helping to develop and administer various mass surveillance programs. They are regularly present at the forum, and according to the sources that I found, may even be involved in funding it and convening it. So what happens really is you have all of these various different contractors, which are in competition with each other and trying to beat each other to contracts. But here at this Pentagon-sponsored forum, they all get together, and they get together with all these other elites and government. They all get together and they talk, and they have these closed-door sessions to feed into how the Pentagon should conduct information operations. So that's a really kind of like, what we see is that actually the shadow intelligence community, is actually very much involved very directly in the formulation of what the Pentagon is actually doing and the way the Pentagon is developing its kind of information warfare strategies across the board and across government. And that's a very kind of disturbing kind of discovery to see, to the extent to which that kind of, the revolving door problem that we're all very familiar with is actually heavily, heavily institutionalized and quite deliberately so by the Pentagon.
Okay, I'd like to go a little further with that, please. I'd like for you to summarize briefly how Google is a product of the U.S. intelligence agencies, and what did the CIA and our intelligence officials and projects that you just mentioned, like the Highland Forum and DARPA, observe in the technology the Google founders were developing that would serve national interest? And indeed, the revolving door between intelligence officials and scientists and Google and other IT firms, that's very extensive. And the revolving door of persons associated with the Highland Forum and Google is also extensive. And as you discovered, most of Google's executives are affiliated with the Pentagon's Highland Forum. So is it fair to say that Google is in some respects another CIA private firm? And then how much faith should we have in Google's claim that it is supporting the higher democratic ideals of free internet access and transparency and freedom of speech and democratic values?
Well, I think that's a really that's a really important question. It really gets to the thrust of the way in which Google has presented itself to us, and really that's that's been the basis of its success is Google's kind of very fun and funky appearance. It's as you were saying, it, you know, it's supposed to have been the result of the kind of the entrepreneurship of these two young guys who were, you know, essentially technological geniuses, you know, and they kind of grabbed the bull by the horns, created this amazing technology. And, you know, they're now pioneering kind of this open idea of the internet and kind of opening access for everybody worldwide. That's the kind of the story of Google that we see in the mainstream. And I think it's for that reason. And, you know, it's become so, because Google's become so embedded in our everyday life, it's as you said, it's a completely, it's almost omnipresent. You know, everyone uses Google. You know, I use Google, and it's an extremely useful tool. And as I pointed out in my articles, you know, on this particular issue, that actually the irony is that I used Google and various Google tools to help me with my investigation, which, you know, we can talk about the implications of that later. But the problem is that Google hasn't been transparent at all about its relationship to the intelligence services. And I think that's really what kind of undermines more than anything this whole kind of narrative, is the extent to which, in my view, Google executives have actually been economical with the truth and have not told the truth about the extent to which they've been assisted by people inside the intelligence services. And if, you know, if they had been honest about that, I think, you know, there would have been a chance to give them the benefit of the doubt to some extent. But the fact that they haven't really does raise questions about what Google's ultimate purpose is and what the ultimate vision is of the people who have nurtured Google. And it goes back to right in the early Stanford days, when Sergey Brin and Larry Page were developing their search engine, and specifically developing PageRank, which was the unique patented tool that they had developed, which really forms the backbone of Google search engine today. Now, from 1996 to 1998, I discovered that Sergey Brin specifically had been partly funded by a program called Massive Digital Data Systems, MDDS, initiative. Now, this was a U.S. intelligence community initiative that had actually been established by the CIA and the NSA specifically. Out of the CIA, it was the CIA's Office of Research and Development. But the management of this program had been contracted to a contractor in the private sector called the very well-known Mitra Corporation. And the person who was managing that was specifically the lead manager was Dr. Bhavani Thurasingam. Now, I spoke to Thurasingam. I interviewed her. She is now a professor at University of Texas in Dallas, very distinguished. She actually heads up the Cybersecurity Research Institute there at the university, which she herself helped to found and helped to raise the money for. She's a renowned expert in data mining, and specifically data mining and counterterrorism. And she was very matter-of-fact. I mean, she basically, and she herself, of course, given her role, not surprisingly, is a very strong proponent of the utility of data mining and the need for data mining. But, however, she is also cautious about the need to protect privacy. And she has said that she does believe that the intelligence community should be working with privacy advocates and lawyers and privacy watchdogs in to make sure that procedures are in place to not allow privacy to be unduly to be unduly breached. And, you know, whatever we make of that, but the fact is that despite that, you know, she is a very strong proponent of, mass surveillance and data mining. But she said to me very matter-of-factly that during her tenure managing this program, and she was co-managing it with a number of senior intelligence officials, including a guy by the name of Rick Steinheiser, who was working for the CIA's Office of Research and Development at that time, And he's also an expert in data mining and counterterrorism. Now, what's interesting is that Rick Steinheiser's name had actually come up previously from another guy who I've interviewed in the past for The Guardian. His name is Robert Steele, and he's a longtime CIA official. He's well known as one of the kind of pioneers of the idea of open source intelligence and their general open source paradigms. And he was also the deputy director of the Marine Corps intelligence activity. So, you know, very senior intelligence official in his time. And he basically confirmed around 2006 or around that time that his sources had told him from the CIA that Rick Steinheiser was the name of the CIA's liaison with Google, and that Steinheiser had apparently played some kind of role in arranging the early seed funding for Google. Now, at that time, of course, you know, there wasn't much detail in that, and Steele was the only source of the information. So, you know, he did that interview, you know, and I think it went viral, and it forced Google to give a statement, not kind of an official statement, but they did speak to, I think, one or two journalists who then put it out on their blogs. Notably, there was hardly any mainstream coverage of Robert Steele's allegations in the first place. But journalists did go out of their way to at least say, well, Google has denied it flat out. And everyone kind of accepted that, okay, you know, Google have denied it, so we believe Google. Now, this is interesting because this is all part of the whole culture that we've been saturated in, of this idea of Silicon Valley being this pioneer of freedom and technological development, and again, all these values that you spoke about. But the problem is that actually the intelligence community, and this is not really anything surprising or anything new, the intelligence community, and especially DARPA, the Pentagon's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, have been, you know, integrally involved in funding lots of startups and kind of really kind of fostering the rise of the internet. Everybody knows that. And what was happening with Sergey Brin in Stanford at that time was exactly part of that process. Now, Sergey Brin was in the right place at the right time. The funding that had come to Stanford and ended up coming partly to Brin from the MDDS was part of a package of funding that had gone through Professor Jeffrey Ullman, who a well-known computer scientist who was supervising a bunch of graduate students at that time, including Brin. So it's in that context that Brin received this funding. But what's interesting is that Sergey Brin met regularly with Professor Thrasingham and her colleague from the CIA, Rick Steinheiser. According to her, she said that Brin would brief them from 96 to 98 every 3 months about his research for a period of two years. So I think even though there's definitely, I would say, you know, to some extent, I don't think we should make more of the funding than it is and kind of make it like it's some grand scheme that was pre-planned. No, I think the intelligence community saw an opportunity in Brin. And whatever the case is, they clearly took a liking to him. They clearly took a very keen interest in his research, in the Google search engine, and they saw the potential. And that is why they took a special interest in seeing him every 3 months.
Nafees, you've given us an enormous amount to think on. We're out of time. I thank you very much for sharing your insights. And we are going to invite you back for a full hour on our Progressive Commentary Hour, because I still have not gotten the broader question, because time did not permit. The intelligence domination of the Internet is only one piece. However, after 9/11 and the launch of the War on Terror, it now seems certain that there has been a formula in place by powerful, influential, and well-funded and resourced contingencies to basically pull all the strings of our civilization and world economies and policies in the extremist neocon project for the new American century, a principal group behind the ascendancy of Bush and Cheney, perhaps as only one among a more shadowy and influential networks that has led us to our Orwellian world and prior to 9/11. So throughout the past 14 years, there has been a stripping away of civil liberties and privacy, and the war on terror is more a strategic ploy to accomplish and implement other policies of control and domination that are fundamentally unrelated to terrorism. So the war on terrorism so far has been a terrible failure, and the world is not any less dangerous today. And one might conclude that this war has never originally intended to make the world safer, but to enable certain elements to access greater control over humanity and the world's resources. So the next time we have a chance to talk, we will begin there, of just what the U.S. and the Western nations and the larger goals and missions of the government intelligence, private economic interests are, and how that's impacting us. Thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Gary Knoll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today, man on fire. Obama sets up rebound from foreign policy missteps.
Right now, Utrice Lead.